Second Thessalonians chapter 3, verses 6 to 15 are our verses for this evening, really focusing on the main issue that Paul seems to have had with the believers in Thessalonica. Chapter 3 of 2 Thessalonians and verse 6, "In the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, we command you, brothers, to keep away from every brother who is idle and does not live according to the teaching you receive from us. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow our example. We were not idle when we were with you, nor did we eat anyone's food without paying for it. On the contrary, we worked night and day, laboring and toiling, so we would not be a burden to any of you. We did this not because we do not have the right to such help, but in order to make ourselves a model for you to follow. Even when we were with you, we gave you this rule: if a man will not work, he shall not eat. We hear that some among you are idle. They are not busy, they are busybodies. Such people we command and urge in the Lord Jesus Christ to settle down and earn the bread they eat. And as for you, brothers, never tire of doing what is right. If anyone does not obey our instruction in this letter, take special note of him. Do not associate with him in order he may feel ashamed. Yet, do not regard him as an enemy, but warn him as a brother." We thank God for his word to our hearts tonight. Our text for tonight is in that passage we read earlier in 2 Thessalonians 3, and I've taken the words of verse 13 in the NIV: never tire of doing what is right. And in case you're wondering who am I getting at tonight, no one in particular. I just think it's something Paul was saying, particularly to Thessalonians, but it has constant reference all the time. That encouragement, the song we've just been singing is, "I promise to serve you to the end." And that call to not be weary in well-doing is part of the passage here. When most of us were young, the pressure that was put upon us to do what was right came from the fear factor. If you don't do that, then, and some awful kind of threat was laid against us. That, of course, is in for dig today. You don't do that sort of thing. And children nowadays are encouraged to expect wonderful things if they're good. If you're good, then you will get, then you will go, then you will enjoy. And so it's not unusual to hear children, or particularly grandchildren nowadays, saying after being good for a little while, "I'm bored of being good," or "I'm tired of being good." And we understand what they're getting at. If only they could relax a while and enjoy just being a wee bit naughty and a wee bit normal. I think Paul knew that it wasn't just children who tire of being good and of doing good. Growing weary in well-doing is something he mentions not just in this letter, but in other letters of the New Testament as well. As well as that particular phrase, he uses other phrases, encouraging God's people in difficult, in trying times, to remember their commitment and to remain faithful to the word and work of God. And so tonight I want to just take that little phrase, "never tire of doing what's right," and set it into the passage as Paul speaks it to these folk in Thessalonica. And the first little comment to have is that issue of getting that lazy feeling, or that really lazy feeling. Sometimes that happens to us in the Christian life, and that's why we need to hear, "never tire of doing what's right." Unlike some people that you know, I'm not a fan of Homer Simpson. I find it repulsive and vulgar and too simplistic, etc. But because I try to keep in touch with the world of today, particularly for Davey's information, I have a little snippet, just to keep up with him, of Homer Simpson lying on a couch in his pajamas, drinking beer. Just one of many reasons why I wouldn't obviously have any time for him at all. Lying on a sofa in his pajamas, drinking beer, and saying to Marge, I just love these lazy Saturdays. To which Marge replies, Homer, it's Wednesday. And he says, oh dear, I better get off to work then. Maybe you stretched out on the sofa this afternoon after lunch and said to the rest of the family, wow, I love these lazy Sunday afternoons. Or maybe you're busy washing the dishes and doing 1,001 other things. But Paul hints, I think, in this chapter that there were people in Thessalonica who rather liked a really lazy feeling, who loved to put up their feet, not after a week's work, not in retirement after a lifetime of hard endeavor, but just in the middle of life thinking it'd be a much easier call to do nothing, to have that really lazy feeling in life. And Paul has a word to say about it throughout this chapter. Why is he concerned? I think there are three things that were motivating some of these folk in the church in Thessalonica to be lazy. I think in verse 6, he says there were lazy people there, and lazy people sometimes infect others. This small core of folk are mentioned both in verse 6 and then again in verse 11. They were deliberately ignoring the instructions they'd been given by Paul in the past, and had developed laziness or idleness as a kind of lifestyle choice for themselves. It appears that for some this was an issue of ignoring daily work, going out for employment. And hence Paul told them in verse 10, I've already told you, said if someone doesn't work, they shouldn't eat. He isn't saying that people should be starved out of existence, but he's making the point that in the church of Thessalonica, those who were sponging off the rest and avoiding the call of daily work were doing something wrong. Very often we hear folk talk disparagingly about, oh, that's a Protestant work ethic. But it's nothing to do with Protestant work ethic. It actually goes back to the heart of creation itself, where God called Adam and Eve and those who followed them to be those who worked, who kept creation under dominion, who served God through their daily work and employment. When the commandments are given, it is that 6 days thou shalt labor, and then the seventh you'll have as your Sabbath. How many sermons have you heard on keeping the Sabbath compared to how many you've heard on making sure you're a good employee, a good worker? So when Paul writes these letters and this particular comment here, he's not condemning the retired, the sick, or the ill who can't work. He's not condemning unemployed people who cannot find employment. He's talking to a small group of people in the church of Thessalonica who had chosen not to bother working any longer, even though they were of employment age and employment ability. This idleness was a choice of lifestyle which involved them living off the kindness and beneficence of fellow believers. So when you go to verse 6, you say, well, why does Paul say, don't keep company with those people? And I think that behind that lies the idea that laziness becomes infectious. And he saw that if there's this tiny group in the church acting this way and getting away with it, then it soon spread its seeds of attitude throughout the rest of the church. It's a bit like yawning. If I just had a great big yawn just now, I could guarantee that 90% of you would do it immediately afterwards, even if you weren't planning to. It's just that kind of infectious thing, and laziness is a bit like that. When the summertime comes round, or maybe it is summertime today, and you see everybody else sunbathing out in their shorts and enjoying themselves somewhere or other, it's hard to work yourself up to full steam of work and endeavor. Laziness is infectious. You go on your holidays, as the kiddies were saying today, whether it's Liverpool or Blackpool or Spain or wherever, and you don't feel like working because everyone's on holiday mood and holiday spirit. I think it's Paul aware that kind of thing is in us as human beings that sees a real danger, that what this small group were doing and we'll look at their reasons for it in a minute, could spread through the whole of the church in Thessalonica, not just in terms of their daily employment and work, but ultimately in terms of church work and witness as well. The typical church that perhaps we've all been acquainted with down through the centuries often has that hard core of enthusiastic workers around it, and the very largest numbers of enthusiastic spectators and observers. And Paul's encouraging the Thessalonican believers to see that laziness catches. And that's why he says, don't mingle with them, not because they are committing some unbelievably bad sin or being incredibly immoral, but somebody knows that that kind of infectious spirit of laziness and idleness could be caught by them as well. Second thing he makes reference to is what I'm calling wrong theology in verse 6. He makes a connection between their laziness and idleness and a failure to live according to his teaching. He starts to say, well, what was going on in Thessalonica? That something about his teaching wasn't being lived out in their practice. If you go back into 1 Thessalonians, you remember that a big chunk at the end of 1 Thessalonians was dealing with a variety of views and opinions, theology, about the second coming of Christ. And it seems there were those in the Thessalonian situation who thought, well, Christ is coming back. He's coming back very, very soon. He's coming back so soon, his arrival is imminent. So we need bother working. Let's just sit back, doing nothing, waiting for his glorious return to come. And you think, well, that's really odd kind of behavior. Look at what's happened over the past few decades in our lifetime. Each time that somebody set a date when Christ is going to be coming back again. There was one not so very long ago, and what happened was people gave up their jobs, they sold their homes and property, and they sat back idly, lazily, doing nothing, waiting for the great moment of Christ's coming. It's not just a Thessalonican problem. It's something that still affects Christianity in every day. A wrong theology about the second coming of Christ can lead to a wrong attitude to the need to continue working until the very end of the journey. I think it's also true that there's a misunderstanding of Bible teaching about separation from the world and devotion to God. Again, the first letter to Thessalonians, he's praised them and thanked God for them because they were devoted to God, they were devoted to the Savior and to his work. But there comes a point in that where you go overboard. And some folks have decided, well, if our task is to be holy people and spiritual people and people of the Word and people of spiritual meditation and theological awareness, then obviously a monastic, contemplative lifestyle is the most spiritual option we could possibly have. What is more holy than devoting your whole life to reading, praying, and meditating on spiritual issues? It's like going to the Irish Baptist College nowadays. But of course, that's wrong theology. And it's not wrong theology to go to Bible college. I don't want to get you there, because they do work them hard there. At least they used to in the old days. But the point is, those who say, well, I'm going to stop working. I'm not going to earn my keep. I'm going to find a little hermitage somewhere or a little retreat somewhere. And I'll leave that big, bad world out there. And I go and hide myself away in a place where I can just devote myself to conversation with the Lord. That might sound like a very spiritual option. For Paul, that would be a very wrong option. It's wrong theology. It's contrary to the teaching he's given these Thessalonians in the past. As far as Paul was concerned, true Christian faith is honed and worked out, not in the hermitage, but in our workplace. The real place where a person's spirituality is fine-tuned is when they're rubbing shoulders morning, noon, and night with people who are not Christians, who are not egging them on spiritually, who are not enthusiastic to see them morally strong. But in that place of battle and spiritual conflict is where our spiritual life actually grows strong. So one or other of those were probably what was happening in the Thessalonian situation. Either some saying, well, Christ is going to come back so soon, so let's just forget about work and let's just wait for his coming. Or else those who are saying, well, you know, we want to be spiritual, we want to be devoted to God, we want to be holy, so let's just quit all the ordinary things of life, let's be separate from the world, and let's be devoted to God, one or other reason, creating actually a lazy, idle, drifting sort of lifestyle. The third thing in verse 8 that contribute to this lovely, lazy feeling in Thessalonica was constant effort. Paul was not Superman, but he says, when I came amongst you, I worked and toiled night and day. We can't help but be impressed by the level at which Paul ministered in terms of gospel work, ministered in terms of pastoral care, ministered in terms of traveling around that whole part of Europe that God had placed him in, and carried on his tent-making role as well. Paul knew only too well that that kind of hectic lifestyle is tiring. And I guess there are times when Paul himself would have woken up in the morning and thought, oh, I'll have a lie-in today. Wouldn't it be great if I didn't have to go to work today? Paul wasn't in another planet to ourselves. He was the same kind of stuff of life as you and I are. So it's not surprising to me that Paul could speak with feeling about growing weary in well-doing. When you trace through Paul's letter to the Corinthians, and he talks about the beatings and the scourgings and the tiredness and the weariness, Paul knew what this was like. And so he writes these people knowing that some of them have got this lazy streak infected by other lazy people. Some are in danger of having a lazy streak infected by this wrong theology of either second coming or of being separate from the world. And some had a danger of getting the lazy streak just because they're tired out by the amount of work they've been doing both in their daily labor and in the cause of Christ itself. Too many were in danger of enjoying that lazy feeling. So it goes on, secondly, to talk what I've put under the heading of the devil finds work for idle hands to do. He didn't coin the phrase, but he might well have used it had it been around in his day. For Paul personally, there had been several reasons why he had worked hard when he was amongst the Thessalonians. He'd wanted, verse 7, then again verse 9, he'd wanted to set them a good example. He says, when I was with you, I worked night and day, I labored hard, I struggled hard, because I wanted to set a good example to you of what being a real Christian was. Not opting for the easy life, but taking on the service and work of God with a heart and a half. Verse 8 gives a second reason why he'd worked hard when he was amongst them and didn't take the lazy option. He'd wanted to avoid being a burden to them. Here, as in Corinthians again, he makes the point it's quite right for himself as an apostle to go into a situation and live off of the goodness and kindness of God's people in that situation. Nothing wrong with that. God has stipulated in the words of Jesus that the ox should be fed, etc. So it wasn't a wrong principle. But Paul's making, but I wanted to be amongst you and not be a burden to you. So therefore, I worked hard to set you a good example, and so you weren't burdened by my presence amongst you. But I think as he writes these words here in verse 11, there's a further, a bigger concern as to why he set that example for them. There's a lovely play on words. It's very hard in the Greek to interpret properly into English. Some of the verses said, don't get busy, but you've got to become busybodies. they contrast the busy in work and the busy bodying that was going on in Thessalonica. And if you get that kind of play on words, you're quite close to where Paul was as he writes to them. He's saying, when you adopt the lazy lifestyle, you might say in your heart, well, I'm doing this because Christ's coming back soon. I want to be there, ready, waiting for him. Or you might say, I'm adopting this lifestyle because I really want to devote myself to the word and to doctrine and to theology and to spirituality. But the devil finds work for idle hands to do. And so what's actually happening to you, if you look at that little group there in the church, he says that they've quit being busy with their work and instead they're being busy bodies instead. How easy it is, and it's all the way through the New Testament, how easy it is to get busy in other people's business, sorting out other people's lives instead of our own. There's actually no hint here in this particular chapter as to what form the busybodying was in Thessalonica. But there are plenty of references in Paul's letters elsewhere to the evils of gossiping and of rumour mongering. So easy, isn't it, to spend our lives as Christians putting other people right, letting them know where they failed, where their theology is not quite up to scratch, where their lives should be better ordered, and a thousand other ways. And Paul says this busybodying in other people's affairs is what happens when people adopt the lazy, idle, drifting lifestyle. The format of that busybodying is not the issue. It's the danger that Satan will occupy those who are not occupied with worthwhile things. Quite a strong note for the Thessalonians, wasn't it? He loved the church there. He was very keen on it. It had become to him one of the best of the fruits of his labor anywhere through Europe. But this one issue deeply bothers him as he looks at the church at that point in time. Getting that really lazy feeling was all too easy when other people were being lazy, when the work and effort had tired you out, and when it seemed like this was a spiritual or theological good option. So what's his words? What's his message? What's his plea with these people? I put it under the heading of keep right on to the end of the road. Persevere to the end. Don't be weary in well-doing. Don't tire of doing good. All good phrases, all good interpretations of what Paul says here. It is, I say, something that he deals with elsewhere. And I would have given you a very exhaustive exposition of what this verse means, but it does occur in Galatians chapter 6, verse 9. And somebody else is doing Galatians these days, and Davey will give it such thorough treatment, I wouldn't like to steal his thunder in advance, so I'll not give you the full theological exposition of what it means not to grow weary in well-doing or to tire in doing good. But I will say it's not just about doing good in terms of giving alms to the poor or sponsoring Gareth in his trip to Cambodia. It implies both of those, and there is that thing that runs through the teaching of Jesus and then the apostles that God's people are called to see the areas of human need around them and minister to them. But when you find weary in well-doing or tiring in doing good, it's not just in that kind of limited aspect. The word that Paul uses here has the idea of anything that's good, worthwhile, anything of noble character, anything that's wholesome. And I want to just leave us with some suggestions of how that message specially applied to those folks to whom Paul was writing. They had to persist in doing things that were wholesome when persecution was tough. Remember back to the start of the letter, as written to Thessalonians, when they're going through times of persecution and opposition. Constant opposition would tire them. Paul knew that from his own bitter experience. He could go out one day and face that onslaught of opposition from one group or the next. But when it went on day after day after day after day, week after week, year after year, it was tiresome. As I think Paul is saying to his folks, when you're tired like that, when you're weary, and you think to yourself, well, I've done enough, I could rest a while now, is important for them as believers to have a wee chat to themselves, a wee pep talk to themselves. Don't weary in well-doing. Don't tire in doing good, even though the persecution is tough. I think he's saying to them, persist in doing good when the road seems long. It's clear they were living at fever pitch at times. They were expecting Christ's return very, very soon. There's something actually that was quite right about living in that light. Living every day believing that Christ's return is sure and certain isn't a bad thing, as long as you don't opt out of the rest of life while you wait. But as time passed, that road, that waiting for Christ, would perhaps seem to get longer and longer and longer. Probably most of you have had the experience of taking the kiddies on holidays, and after you've left home on your long journey to the continent, you're about 5 miles from home when the first one says, "Are we nearly there yet?" And if you haven't had it with kiddies, you'll probably get them with grandchildren. Are we nearly there? The tiresomeness of what seems like a non-ending road. And I guess that for Paul, writing to these folk in Thessalonica, it was a bit like that. He knew there would become a weariness just waiting and waiting, waiting. The road ahead was long and toilsome. And they needed to remind themselves, let's keep on going. Let's not weary in well-doing. And the third and last comment is, I think he would have said it to them when encouragement was meager. If you watch Sports Relief on Friday night, like Davey did, I only saw a tiny bit of it, but you'd have seen people who were doing massive amounts of physical activity, and who said afterwards that what kept them going were all the people along the route, and the people who actually ran alongside of them, or the people who swam alongside or rode alongside them, is other people being there, encouraging them, kept them going. But otherwise, they'd have given up and taken a wee lazy spell with a heart and a half. Sometimes in the Christian life, we're like marathon runners who have the road around us lined with people encouraging us along the way. You might think of yourself either in your daily work or more likely in terms of your Christian service and work. And you might think, well, it's brilliant. It's dead easy because everyone's encouraging me and exhorting me and enthusing me and showing me how good the work is and how much I've been blessed by it. So it's great, dead easy. But I guarantee that most of you have had the other experience where you feel like a long-distance runner in total isolation with not a soul in sight, running down a thin, narrow, hilly road, and you think to yourself, I can't go on any further, and there's nobody there clapping you, nobody there cheering you on, nobody saying, wow, you're doing brilliantly at the moment. Nobody saying, well, I'll take a wee run along with you for a while. You're totally isolated and highly discouraged. And the easiest thing in the world would say, well, nobody's watching, I'll take a breather. I'll give up. Paul says to these folk in Thessalonica, don't get weary in well-doing. Don't tire of doing good. You may get tired doing it, but don't give up. What God has called you and me to, he's called us to continue with right to the end of the road. And that's why he's saying, oh, Jesus, I have promised to serve you to the end. And that's why Paul encouraged these folks in Thessalonica to do exactly the same. Life isn't always a breeze, is it? Christian life and service isn't always full of encouragement, but God calls us to persevere right to the very end.